Let me introduce you to Jonathan Gustin, a non-dual spiritual teacher of great integrated wisdom. And I think you're going to love the conversation that Roger and I had with him. It gets really good. Welcome to Deep Transformation, Self, Society, Spirit, life-enhancing, paradigm-rattling conversations with cutting-edge thinkers, contemplatives, and activists, with Dr. Roger Walsh and John Dupuy. Join us in the evolutionary fast lane as we take a deep dive into transformational practice, peak experience, profound understanding, powerful contribution.
I'm Roger Walsh, and our co-host is John Dupuy, founder of iAwake Technologies. And our guest today is Jonathan Gustin. Jonathan is many, many things, many roles. He's a meditation teacher, and he's particularly is a founder and lead teacher of the Purpose Guides Institute. Jonathan has devoted much of his life to exploring purpose and the role that plays in our lives, the optimal purpose we can find to guide us, and how to facilitate and help others find their optimal purpose. Like many of us, Jonathan is deeply concerned about the state of the world, and especially climate change. But unlike most people, Jonathan is looking deeper. Jonathan is looking at questions not just what should they do, or even what can I do, but still deeper to questions such as how can we respond to the global crises, and particularly the climate crisis, as a contemplative and spiritual practice, as a way of working to foster the best in ourselves, to cultivate beneficent qualities, virtues, capacities, and to render ourselves ever more effective instruments of service. It's a beautiful aspiration and a beautiful purpose. Jonathan, welcome. It's a pleasure to have you with us. And maybe we can start by asking, what moved you to devote so much of your time and energy to climate change, and what in particular inspired you to approach it as a spiritual practice?
Well, first of all, thank you, both of you, for having me on the podcast. I'm looking forward to a conversation, hopefully more than just a pure interview. So please absolutely feel free to tell me where you think I'm missing the point or whatever. I'd rather co-create something than just spew. Well, actually, since I was very young, 12, I had this kind of epiphany where I came to understand that I wanted to be part of the solution for the world's ills and be of service. But kind of co-arising with that was this notion, well, I would have to be wise. And the word that came to me, although I didn't know what it meant, and I still actually don't know what it means, is the word enlightenment. So I was like, okay, so if I'm going to really be a good earth steward and be of true assistance and support, then I would actually have to be wise, enlightened. So flash forward to, I guess I was 20, and I had something of a vision and an auditory, sort of pronouncement. And I heard these words, whole person midwifery. And I was like, ah, that's it. That's me. Now, I had never heard those words before at that time, not even close. And I knew instantly I wasn't, there to catch babies and be a traditional midwife. That was obvious that it was, imaginal realm, whole person midwifery. And I realized it would take me decades to train to be even possibly adequate for that. So I went to California Institute of Integral Studies, where actually I met you, Roger, way back like 30 years ago or something. Became a psychotherapist sort of as my day job, but I really had my eye on bringing spiritual practice and activism together. In 2000, I founded Green Sangha, a spiritually based environmental activist organization, with the notion that a lot of activists end up burning out because it's just so, to take on just the information, let alone be on the front line and doing the work, it's a heavy load. And I was convinced and still am that meditation has so much to offer the quote unquote activist community. But it was actually even the other side that was even more important to me, because I came up in two non-dual traditions, the Zen tradition and the Hindu or Advaita Vedanta, Hindu non-dual tradition. Though I did see some activism, I didn't see a lot. Though I did hear some teachings, you know, about the Bodhisattva and so forth, I didn't see it really pushed right to the center. And that bothered me, still does. And so Green Sangha was an effort to bring those two together. So to flash forward to 2024, today, what's really interesting me is the interface between non-duality and the metta crisis. These are terms we can kind of, I've been writing a paper. I was hoping to have it done. My colleague, friend, and teacher, John Prendergast, and I are writing it. I actually wrote the first draft. He's got it now. And so how can the meta crisis inform non-duality? How can non-duality and spiritual practice be updated by the lights of the meta crisis? Mm-hmm. And how can the meta crisis be informed by the understanding, the wisdom, the depth, the freedom of non-duality? So I don't have the answer. It's a work in progress. Even the word meta crisis itself, no one has the definition. Non-duality, nobody has the definition. But I have working definitions. And to me, it's a really important project. It's deeply occupying my time right now.
Yeah, beautiful. And we should acknowledge that these are questions to which, as in all wisdom questions, to which there's no one-time answer. They're more like the term you use, koans, that each time we ask them, invite us deeper into the question, deeper into ourselves and deeper into life. And so I think these questions you're asking are the questions of our time in many ways. It feels like the meta crisis, and yes, we'll love to have you speak how you understand that. The meta crisis is the context for most everything in our contemporary world. And it reframes so many of the issues and questions of our time, and really needs to be a contextual consideration for anything we do. So, John, I'll ask a question. I saw John nodding his head along there, so I know he wants to jump in a moment, but well, maybe I should just let you jump in, John.
I was actually doing really well, Roger. You're handling it.
You okay, know. Well,
if my whole task is just to deeply listen, I'm okay with that too. Yeah, I was interested in the non-duality part, and you're a non-dual teacher and teaching non-duality, and that's a big buzzword in certain segments of society. And I too, at a very young age, had a non-dual experience when I was 11. I think it was 11 or 12, and it was everything is God, and God is love, and oh my God. You know, that seems like the most important thing anybody can ever know. And why hasn't anybody said anything to me about this? And so that launched me on, not as a stable state, non-dual person living in bliss in every moment, but it shaped my life. And it raises all kinds of questions, you know, if that ultimate reality seems to be so good. And why does evil exist? You know, and why are we behaving in such a way that not only are we destroying one another, but all other living creatures who become so ultimately sacred and precious as we deepen to this reality, the non-dual unitive. And it's not just an intellectual idea, but it's a wholly felt experience that just presents a whole bunch of new problems. And doesn't make things easier, but it's life-changing. And I have a bunch of questions around that. And why does that experience alone not change people and build character? Because I see a lot of going on this bodhisattva vow, a life of service and giving and being part of the solution, as you're suggesting, takes some real characterological deep shifting so that you do care and it's not all about you, that you get beyond natural narcissism or even unnatural narcissism to a place where you truly and deeply care and are willing to be guided by that understanding.
Yeah, great question. Well, so first just to say something about non-duality and then to your question, just a simple definition. I mean, non-duality simply means not two. So the question is reality. Is reality diverse? Well, yes, but is the deepest level of reality, are there actually separate people? Are there separate things? And so I make a distinction between the word separate and individual. So for instance, a metaphor I like to use is if you have a night watchman and they have a screen and they has, you know, 9 or 12 different little cameras, CCTV cameras. So on the screen, you see all of them, and his awareness is the awareness which perceives all the different viewpoints of the different cameras for the building that he's securing. But they don't have an independent existence, ultimately, in terms of perception. There's one perceiver. So now in mysticism or non-duality, we understand the mystery, God, Tao, call it what you will, it doesn't matter to me. I'll use all those terms and more. There's nothing but that. And with 8 billion people, what we have is 8 billion different points of view, one consciousness. So that's 8 billion different CCTV cameras, if you will, and one consciousness that is animating and permeating all of them. Everything is that. There is nothing other than that. And the delusion is that individuality equals separation. And it's very pervasive. My parents treated me like I was an individual. It's just their parents treated, you know, it's a thing. And it may be, and this is speculative, that human beings are on an evolutionary arc where more and a higher and higher degree of percentage of people actually awaken to this. But then there's the whole embodiment problem, which we'll get to in just a second, which you were pointing out. But I just wanted to stop there with the non-duality, because it's a strange concept if people aren't used to it.
Yeah, and we should emphasize here, I think you used a great word for it, John, that it's a buzzword these days, for better and worse. And Jonathan, so you were using one, and it has come to have multiple meanings. Yeah. One is simply a sense of experiential non-separation, of not being separate from the world around me or even the cosmos or humankind, etc. But the traditional use was a deeper one, which you were pointing to, Jonathan, of the underlying unity of reality and a pre-separation nature to, or ontology, to use the technical term. So I just want to point out that emphasize your point, John, that non-duality was a buzzword, and second, that it now has multiple meanings. And Jonathan, you're using it in a very specific, traditional way.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you saying that. So the words, you know, non-duality and meta-crisis have so many different layers, and different teachers will shine a light on different layers. So yeah, it has become a buzzword. It's become watered down in some circles. That's fine. I mean, words have a life of their own, and they do what they do. They evolve, devolve, and evolve again. But this deeper notion, it's not just about the realization of no separation. There's another part, which is responsibility. It's my contention that non-dual traditions that don't put front and center, or at least push to some degree towards the center, the responsibility aspect, that as an individual, a non-separate individual, it's not just the realization of non-separation, but the care, that the circle of care, right? So you care about your body, you know, unless you're Ramana Maharshi, and he's an interesting example. But in the end, he did kind of come out of that samadhi state. He's a great Indian sage who's my root teacher, who I met when I was 16. There's a difference between waking up and feeling a kind of a divine shrug. I will admit that there are moments in very deep meditation when the Jonathan character seems to soften and even dissolve, that there isn't an impulse in that deep, I'm sitting on the couch, I'm meditating, I'm cross-legged, and I'm not necessarily feeling that bodhisattva vow that I took when I was lay ordained in the Zen tradition. I'm just feeling, just at one with everything. But then the question is the kind of off the couch, if you will. Is what I see before me, am I responsible for it? Well, if I see my son and my wife, that's a no-brainer. Yeah, well, they're within my circle of care. But where I think sometimes the embodiment piece, which you could say post-awakening, if you want, so it gets a little tricky, is the realization that we are responsible to life. That doesn't mean you have to take care of 8 billion people. That's impossible, right? That's a savior complex and it's going to burn you out. but responsible to like what is calling you. And that gets to the piece of purpose. So in Hinduism, there's this word moksha, liberation, freedom. It has a number of, you know, freedom from samsara, freedom from rebirth and so forth. It depends on how you use it. Let's call it enlightenment, awakening, liberation. And then there's this word dharma, right? Your duty, your purpose, your path, what you're responsible to. Well, I appreciate that in Hinduism, they semi-discreetly separated these terms, but you're not actually supposed to just push all your chips into moksha or all your chips into dharma. There are some versions of the Hindu teachings that say the highest desire, the highest impulse is moksha. I actually don't see moksha and dharma as being separate. I think a hyphenate word, moksha dharma, or to, those are Sanskrit words, to put it in English, liberation service, liberation service.
Yeah. And I think if we use what is the most widely employed model theory of motivation in the West, it's Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which he postulated, you know, first you have to satisfy basic physiological and survival needs with the thirst and food and security and etc. And then social needs, belonging needs, and self-esteem needs. But then he pointed to self-actualization beyond that. And then his later life, he pointed to self-transcendence as the peak, the motive at the top of the pyramid. But I'm willing to make a very strong argument beyond self-transcendence is selfless service. And I think you're pointing exactly to that. And that out of self-transcendence can come. It doesn't, as John was pointing to, it doesn't invariably come, particularly out of just one-time experiences. I think that was your key point, John. But as you're pointing to, Jonathan, that ideally, under the right circumstances, self-transcendence spontaneously expresses itself in selfless service.
Yeah. So I think there are at least two ways to come to that. You can come to that through self-transcendence, and then you can kind of come, you can put purpose discovery between self-actualization and self-transcendence, if you will.
So very nice. Okay. Yeah. Keep going with this one.
Yeah. Well, so there are people for whom the first legitimate deep spiritual question is, what do I do? And there are others for whom the first legitimate deep spiritual question is, who am I? If you go the who am I route, like Ramana Maharshi's Atma Vichara, who am I at my deepest depths? And you discover you are none other than the undivided, the timeless, the boundless unit of intimacy with everything. And so this you could call, if you want to, you could call it classical or traditional enlightenment. But for other people, maybe they're more action-oriented, less, you know, I like to sit in meditation. I don't know, what can I say? But for other people, it's like the first question is, how can I serve? What is my place? What is my niche or niche, you know, in the habitat of life? And we see some of this in indigenous societies, right? The vision quest ceremony. You go out. I know, John, you're a wilderness quest guide or a vision quest guide.
For many years.
Many years. Yeah. So weigh in after I just finished the sentence. I'm really curious if you see it this way, that question is what brings people out to fast and pray, to basically meditate in the desert in a fashion and receive a vision, receive a piece of the puzzle. Like, what am I called to do, right? And instead of an ascent, if you will, to nirvana, to heaven, to the unbounded, it can feel like a descent. Who is that teacher? Thomas Berry. He said an incendence, right? Where you dig down deep inside you and find soul. So I like this word soul and spirit. Now they're not different, but they are. And so soul to me is what I'm here to embody in this lifetime. But it itself is just an emanation or modulation of the mystery and spirit itself. And a total, and like our total reality, as Almas puts it, is includes both, of course.
Yeah, I think that you brought up the Native American thing. And I had a teacher from Lakota tradition, a medicine man. And I found in the native, they have such a beautiful non-dual way of expressing things. The brother wolf, brother sky, sister moon, San Franciscan also, all our relations and all their prayers, they say all our relations, all our relations. And in that context, which is also preciously personal and non-dual at the same time, then you go in the vision quest and say, great spirit, have pity on me, show me the way so I can know how to serve my people. It's so elegant and so beautiful. I think that wisdom can help us with some of the problems that we're dealing with in your work and confronting us all right now.
Yeah, I don't necessarily do a good job, but, as I said, Ramana Maharshi, this great Indian sage, shockingly introduced himself to me at 16. I mean, he is long deceased. So I've been a student of his. He's been a root teacher for me. And he's like a one loincloth classical Indian sage type of guy. On the other hand, the wisdom of Native Americans has been so important to me. And so my morning ritual is like very odd. I will begin with what you just said, all my relations. Aho means hello, Matakwiasan, all my relations. And I begin with, I take oatmeal instead of tobacco, but it can be anything just as an offering. And I face each of the directions and I extend my awareness. So if I'm facing the east, I'm thinking of China and Japan and Korea, and I'm just feeling the whole planet. As opposed to just closing my eyes and facing a wall or something like that, I do each of these directions. And then I include my relationships with the wingeds and the swimmers and the creepy crawlies and the ashes and bones of my ancestors under my feet. And I ask them to help me be a support to them. And I can do it in the other order too. And then I do what you might call a classical Zen, shikantaza, just sitting meditation, or koan practice, or atmavichara, who am I, Vaita Vedanta. To me, these two really together, I love that I live now in 2024. And I can be, I'm not Indian, and I'm not, Hindu Indian, and I'm not Native American. And yet they have informed me, and the two together really work so beautifully. And I think maybe their accent of attention might be a little different, but it doesn't even, it's all there in both of them. And I like what you said, John, that actually for a long time, I thought of non-duality as Ramana Maharshi and Zen. And I thought of the vision quest ceremony in Native American traditions as more the soul piece, but actually they have a non-dual tradition, but it's more animistic. It's more nature. The mysticism. It's more
embodied,
shamanic,
in some sense,
embodied, yeah. But it's actually non-duality. And it would be very interesting if you could get Black Elk and Ramana Maharshi together. I speculate that they would understand each other. Now, I could be wrong.
I got to tell a story here, John, yeah. Because I'm not, who knows what would happen, but some years ago, the people at Insight Meditation Society brought Sansanim, who's the head of the Korean Zen tradition, and, who's the Tibetan who spent 13 years in retreat, Kalu Rinpoche, together, and sat them down for tea. And at a certain point in the conversation, which was being translated, Sansanim grabbed an orange from the table and thrust it in front of Kalu Rinpoche's face and said, "What is this? What is this?" And after he asked it three times, Kalu Rinpoche turned to his translator and said, "Don't they have oranges in Korea?" So who knows what would happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
But a beautiful point. Yeah, I mean, you're pointing, humor aside, I mean, that's a classic story of our times, but humor aside, you're pointing to many things. One is that we are, for the first time in history, we can be heirs of all the world's wisdom. And we can freely use the practices from multiple traditions without fear of ending up on a funeral pyre, for example. And that these are available to us as they have not been for 2,000 years in Alexandria. So this is amazing. And you're also pointing to the fact that different traditions have different emphases. And you are very beautifully, out of your own intuitive seeking and wisdom, finding what aspects and emphases of these two traditions work for you and complement each other. It's a beautiful paradigm of our time.
Yeah, it is like a new Alexandria. YouTube University is what I call it. Alexandria YouTube. I'm not a shill for Google, so please know that. That said, I can sit there with John Vervaeke and Jonathan Rauston and Daniel Schmachtenberger, the last two who did pieces with you. So I want to highly recommend those two on the meta crisis. They're amazing. It's just, I've never met those guys. You have. I get to sit with them and listen and re-listen, learn from geniuses. It's really an amazing time to avail yourself. Now, you don't want to overdo it. I sometimes do. Yeah. I listen to one of these 3-hour things and I'm like, I can't sleep. I wonder why. So anyway.
And every type of music that's ever been recorded, it's all there. Talk about no generations before us have ever had anything that approaches this. God help us to use it in a wise way.
Yeah, I listen to classical. I listen to jazz. People who, you know, Oscar Peterson, who I didn't get to see while he was alive. And Tatum, you know, I mean, it's just Art Tatum. I mean, I'm just like, wow. It's so, and we're going to get to the poly crisis in a moment, but let's just also admit that we are also living in that the ones who are privileged, right? Middle-class people with plenty of food to eat. I go to this, I sent my 14-year-old son shopping for the first time and he was like a little nervous. He's like, oh, I don't know about that. And he came back and he went, wow, you just push the cart. And you just like lettuce and avocado and, you know, and he's just like amazed. And I'm like, that is so fortunate. You want pistachio nuts? You get the pistachio nuts. You want orange juice? You take it. We middle-class Americans, I'm in Canada right now, are incredibly fortunate.
Yes.
Incredibly so. Amazing.
Yeah.
I read a figure which really put things in context for me. You know, we talk a lot about the 1%. And what they ought to be doing. Well, it turns out that to be in the top 1% of income on the planet, you need an annual income of $34,000 a year.
I share that with my students all the time.
Yes.
Yeah. So many of my friends and colleagues and students, we are in that category, 1%. I thought it was 32,000, so I guess it went up 2,000. That's extraordinary to be in the planetary 1%.
Yeah. Yeah.
What a fortune. What luck.
And it speaks very deeply to your life's work, Jonathan, of given that fact, what should my purpose be?
Yeah. Yeah.
And responsibility, given all that we've been given, you know, what do we do with that?
Well, to come back to Maslow's hierarchy of needs, if I were in Syria or Gaza or any number of places, certain African countries that are experiencing famine. So survival, safety would be the first things. And if I didn't have any friends, that feeling of belonging, feeling of being part of a group of people who, you know, we can give and receive love. If we have those sufficiently covered, I don't mean gloriously covered, but sufficiently covered, then there's bandwidth for, and I don't really want to divide them, but I will because of language, spirituality and service, or service spirituality. And it is such a joy because you have an abundance of love and now you have enough calories, a roof over your head, and you can actually spend some time, not just your little inner circle, your family, your tribe, but now we live in a planetary civilization. And we can consider, though we can't take responsibility for the whole thing, we can now consider the entire planet in what we do. We're not going to be perfect. Do not think that's possible, at least for me anyway, but to continually improve, continually take a little gentle stretch into responsibility.
Yeah, it seems that given that, you know, I have friends that live in Israel. There were, you know, I had friends who died in this whole thing and friends that live in Kyiv, and they say they get missile attacks. I think it's Monday and Tuesdays, and every holiday, you know, they can just count on it. This is human beings doing it to other human beings, just randomly blowing up stuff.
Yeah.
And I've experienced this. If we don't have access, occasionally, Maslow said maybe only once in your life did you have this experience that changes everything. But it is very hard to confront the suffering and the pain and the meta crisis and the planetary crisis without that expanded sense of infinite self as being part of what you can experience. Otherwise, as a very empathetic person, it can crush you with the pain and the darkness.
Yeah. So absolutely. And I've had each face looking at the material, right? So I've had times where it was clear to me that I was looking at, let's say, the climate crisis, preparing for one of these events I do. I invite people, Terry Patton, who you know, and he was alive, he did it. Joanna Macy did one, and Dushanti did one with me. And we called it Climate Change as Spiritual Teacher. And I would do all this preparation. And sometimes I was just Jonathan, and I'd get crushed. I'd be, oh my God, I'd be like a puddle on the ground. And that was a signal to me of the place, the viewpoint from which I was relating to the material as a separate individual. I was like, okay, yeah, all right. You know, when I'm a separate individual, then there's that kind of level of suffering. A much better way of meeting that is, for me personally, meditating, doing the all my relations meditation, then informing myself and allowing this energy, this love energy, to move forward. And that's a sustainable path. To your question about purpose, I think it's really behooves us when we see, you know, we've got poverty and we've got racism. We've got over 30,000 nuclear devices. We have climate change. We have ecosystem. It's just too much. And so, you know, it's just, what do? Throw a dart and decide which one? You can listen to your heart and see which one rises to the top and calls to you. And you can also go on a spiritual path. And this is what I teach at Purpose Guides Institute, is to take that journey with the question, what is truly mine to do? And I would call this a soul purpose awakening or soul purpose enlightenment.
Yes.
Semi-distinct, although not completely distinct, from classical enlightenment. And it is a way of, like, this notion that I had, this vision of whole person midwife, I regard it as a soul name, as something offered by the imaginal realm. In Sufism, they call it Alam al-Mithal, the imaginal realm. Corban and Ibn Arabi and Sudrawardi talked about this. It is possible to access this dimension of us and discover that soul isn't in us. We are in soul. And the Jonathan characters, I'll use my own name, can have a spiritual awakening or epiphany to my soul name. Jonathan was a name that was given to me by my parents. It's serviceable. It's fine. It's what they told me my name was. But I was named on that day. I was meditating, doing a three-week meditation in a cavern in Northern Ontario, Canada. And between the meditations, I remember this one time, there's a couch in the cabin. I'm lying there and I'm contemplating my life. But I'm not just thinking it. I'm like, what am I going to do with this one wild, precious existence, as the poet Mary Oliver put it.
Yeah.
And that's when I heard the words, whole person midwife. And that wasn't something I could have sat there and think, oh, I'll take this word and I'll take this word and so forth. So this is something that I want people to take seriously, because as far as I can tell, in Christianity and Judaism, especially the kind you get in the mainline or mainstream, you know, Christian churches and synagogues, you're not going to be necessarily told that you have a soul level purpose and that you can have a soul encounter, that you can have a, what is that Bill Putnam calls it? A mythopoetic identity. Not a beautiful term. Mythopoetic. Yes. So I understand my purpose through this mythopoetic identity of whole person midwife. I can never name precisely what my deepest purpose is, but that name itself is an orienting principle. So no matter what I do, whether I'm a psychotherapist, which I am, an activist, which I am, a non-dual student who sometimes teaches, which I am, and so forth, I always know that wherever I go, really, I am there to attempt to midwife more wholeness in the individuals and collectives that I have the honor to meet and attempt to make some difference with.
Beautiful. Wow, that's so exquisite. Jonathan, that whole person midwifery, my English Australian background's coming in as midwife. It's my
midwifery.
Midwifery, well, whatever. But that concept, which of course is more like a Rorschach test than, or as with all concepts, I guess the technical term is they're polysemous. They have multiple potential meanings. So how do you, or polyvalent, multiple values, how do you, how has this your understanding and feeling into this evolved over time?
Yeah. When I first received the term, and I also, it was, had a vision too. I could see like it looked like a table that a woman would give birth on. And then I was standing there. I was like, well, I know I'm destined to be that, but it's going to take years of training and I'm going to have to grow into my understanding of it. And what I discovered that I needed some other terms. I'm a term guy. I enjoy them. And so the Native American term, the giveaway, what specifically would be a giveaway or a unique transformational process that would allow me to be a whole person midwife? Because whole person midwife doesn't tell you what you're going to actually do. So psychotherapy is a delivery vehicle, right? Just as you can order a pizza and it can come by bike or an electric car or a Hummer, right? But the pizza is the pizza. So I do whole person midwifery, but I do it as a metacrisis activist one day, the next day as a psychotherapist, the next day as a soul purpose guide, and the next day as a non-dual student who sometimes teaches. So these are delivery vehicles for my soul level purpose to be a whole person midwife in this lifetime. And that's really important because sometimes people come and they think, oh, what I want is the name of my career in the world. And my opinion, and I don't know much about career counseling, so I could be talking out of turn, but I think it is actually better to know who you are at a soul level and then consider the options of careers rather than go for career first. You can do it in either direction. That's quite fine. And then I think your soul level values, what really is most important to you? And then who are your people, right? Because a whole person midwife could work with, you know, kindergarten students potentially. I am absolutely not cut out to be in a class with 35-year-olds, right? So it's not like I can just do anything. I have to be whole person midwife and Jonathan. What's Jonathan cut out for, right? My sister is a doctor. She's a palliative care doctor. That much blood would not, that would not go well with me. So it's very specific. Then you have to ask, who are your people? What are my powers or my talents? What am I good at? Am I good at medicine? Is that my thing? No. Am I good with working with five-year-olds? No. So you really, it becomes very clear that the path is actually quite narrow, which is beautiful. I don't need to be able to do it. I don't want to do everything. I don't want to be a high school teacher. I don't want to be an accountant or a lawyer. So what are the places where I will experience the most joy, right? What really brings me alive? And this one quote from Frederick Buechner, I say more often than any other. He said, find the place where your deepest gladness and the world's deep hunger meets.
Yeah.
I'll say that again. Find the place. You'll find God.
Yeah.
Find the place where your deepest gladness, your deep joy, and the world's deep hunger meets. So I love these things that I just mentioned. They bring me alive. If I won the lottery, you know, it's like that lottery test. What would change? Well, I would drink better wine. I'd stay in nicer hotels. You know, I'd travel more. Sure, I'd indulge. But would I quit my day jobs? I am very lucky. I don't believe I would. Now, this hasn't been tested. I don't have $10 million. But if I did, would I continue to do what I do? That's an interesting thing. Yeah. And my answer, I think it's a speculation, right? Is yeah, it's the question of destiny, right? And providence. Like what am I actually meant to be doing? And I think joy is a really high indicator, but it has to also be what the world needs. When I was young, I wanted to play drums and I wanted to ski. So I was a musician and a ski racer. Well, I wasn't a very good musician and I wasn't a very good ski racer. So the world was not going to want me, pay money to watch me do other of those things. So it's not just about the things that bring you alive. That's joy. And that's great. It's really important at this time of the polycrisis and metacrisis to feed and nourish yourself the things that are juicy and joy-giving. I can walk to Herman's Jazz Club in 2.2 miles from where I'm living now, and I go there a couple times a month because I just enjoy it. Is it my sole purpose? No. Jonathan just likes it.
But it's feeding really, your soul.
Exactly.
It's feeding your soul. Yeah.
Beautiful. Well, there's so much in what you've said, Jonathan. And that beautiful quote, find the place where your deepest gladness and the world's deep hunger meet. Who was that? Who was that?
Frederick Buechner. I'm not even sure. He's passed away now. He's a theologian, a Protestant theologian.
Beautiful. And
yeah. Beautiful. It's amazing.
And it reminds me of several things, and it also relates to several points you made. First off, you emphasize the importance of finding what we could call one's unique calling. And I think several people have used that term. You've probably used it in your own purpose work. And very similar to the Indian yogic idea, and you mentioned the term dharma, one's traditionally translated as one's duty, but it's a much broader and deeper term than that. It's one's calling, one's ethical and life practice and spiritual practice. And in the yogic tradition, there's the idea that one's svadharma, one's unique dharma, should be or is an expression of one's svabhava, one's unique being. And as you were pointing out, to the extent, so part of our work is to find out most deeply who we are, and then to allow that to express itself. And you also mentioned the importance of it being done out of joy rather than sacrifice. A very important concept. When service is done out of, when one does something for oneself alone, that's selfishness. When one does it for others alone, that's sacrifice. And neither of them are particularly helpful motives. But to do it out of joy, and I'm reminded of that quote by Joseph Campbell, follow your bliss. And it's a very deep idea. Not follow your happiness or follow what makes you, gives you kicks. Follow your bliss. Bliss being conceived as the deepest joy that goes with, as you know better than I, the Hindu tradition, the fundamental nature of existence is described as conscious being bliss. So this is a really pointing at something very deep, beautifully pulled together. Thank you so much.
Stay tuned for part two of our conversation with Jonathan Guston and the amazing energetic field of wisdom and inspiration that was created by our getting together and talking about these things. And in addition, to remind you, we have an upcoming Integral Conference in Denver, Colorado, called the ICON, Integral Conference of North America, the Future of Humans. And it is May 16th through 19th, so the day is fast approaching. So I'd love to see you there. It's not just about the speakers, it's about the community of loving human beings that get together that share a very important take on the nature of reality. Thank you very much for being a part of this conversation. We hope that you were moved as we are moved being part of it ourselves. We'd also like to say that this is being funded by Roger and myself. It comes out of our pockets. So if you would like to help us to mainly to get this podcast out to more people, because the bigger audience have, which is steadily growing, but the more people we can reach and the more marketing we can do, the more positive effect we can have on the world. So we've done a couple of ways, but we'd like you to buy us a cup of coffee. Very simple. And I do that with podcasts that I support, and I find it's very satisfying. So thank you for your help. Thank you for your presence, and thank you for all you are and all you do. We love you.